This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on August 29, 2006. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. The Federal Election Commission open meeting for Tuesday, August 29th, 2006 will come to order. Our first item of business this morning, correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move for the consideration and approval of the minutes for August 3rd, 2006 as set forth in agenda document 06-54.
Vice Chairman, so moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries by a vote of 6-0. Our next item of business this morning is a couple of advisory opinions. The first one, advisory opinion 2006-21, which is submitted by Cantwell 2006 and Matthew S. Butler as campaign manager. We have Robert Knopp, S. Severa, and Dwayne Pugh from the General Counsel's Office on this matter. And, Mr. Vice Chairman, we have a late submitted document with respect to this AO.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move for the suspension of the rules for the timely submission of documents to consider agenda document 06-55A.
Vice Chairman is so moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries by a vote of all six commissioners present. Mr. Knopp, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Agenda documents 0655 and 0655A respond to an advisory opinion request from Cantwell 2006. Cantwell 2006 is the principal campaign committee of Senator Maria Cantwell from Washington State. Senator Cantwell is running in the upcoming Democratic primary against five other Democratic candidates. That election will be held on September 19th. That date is also the date of the Republican primary in Washington State. There are six Republicans running in the Republican primary. One of those candidates is Michael McGavick, who has loaned his campaign $2 million. Senator Cantwell's committee anticipates that the McGavick campaign will spend a significant amount of his personal funds on communications attacking Senator Cantwell prior to the September 19th primary. The committee asks two questions. First, the committee asks whether Senator Cantwell may consider any of the expenditures Mr. McGavick makes before the primary to be in connection with the general election. The draft concludes that she may not, because those expenditures are in connection with the primary election only, and Mr. McGavick is not Senator Cantwell's opposing candidate in the primary. Second, the committee asks whether any personal funds that remain in a campaign's account for the general election will count toward the general election threshold for Millionaires Amendment purposes. The draft concludes that they will and goes on to say that both campaigns must use a reasonable accounting method to determine the portion of their cash on hand that constitutes the candidate's personal funds. The amendment in Agenda Document 06-55A would simply add a reference to one of the Commission's presidential candidate expenditure regulations in the answer to the committee's first question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Knopp. Discussion of the drafts before us. Are we prepared to entertain a motion? Commissioner Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make a couple of points about this request, and of course we have a similar request from Senator Kyle pending, which just I think goes to confirm that this cuts either way in terms of parties. Self-finance candidates aren't the province of one party or the other. First, there's an argument, essentially the fundamental argument that's being made here is a fairness argument. I mean, there are a lot of technical arguments having to do with the state of the ballot, and for instance, the state of the ballot is different apparently in Arizona than it is here, and some factual differences have been raised there about, alleged anyway, about the content of the ads. But it sort of revolves around the generic argument that McGavick is using this money to attack Cantwell, and so it ought to be fair for Senator Cantwell to be able to take advantage of the increased election limits. And I think the big problem with an appeal to fairness over the specific technical requirements of the statute and the rule is that Congress drew a very detailed statute, an incredibly detailed statute, designed to ensure fairness. It's very clear that was what they were trying to do, because they put in variable limits based on the state size, the primary versus the general election, this cash on hand advantage, which is calculated differently for the general election and the primary, and so Congress set up a structure designed to try to achieve fairness, and so we can't, in an effort to seek fairness, ignore the structure that Congress set up, even when we look at it and say in certain circumstances it may produce somewhat anomalous results. I also want to note that Congress was not unconscious of specifically this problem when they passed the bill, because before the bill was passed, I made a speech which I was criticized about and for various reasons by various people, which, among other things, brought attention to the provisions of the Millionaires Amendment and its possible consequences. And I used, as an example, the Cantwell-Gorton race, in which Senator Cantwell in her initial campaign spent about $10 million financing her own race, and noted that a wealthy candidate with good legal advice might postpone the triggering effects of this amendment, the Millionaires Amendment, until well into the general election period. In states with late primaries, this might postpone increases in contribution limits until October, and then went on to analyze that in the Washington race, under the statute, Senator Cantwell would have been eligible to receive increased contributions just within the last couple of weeks of the race, despite then-candidate Cantwell's spending $10 million on the race, and laid this all out in some detail. And Congress passed the statute, you know, in the form that it is now. It's very difficult to then come back and say, well, Congress didn't mean this or didn't understand it. I also want to note that the situation, as I pointed out 6 years ago, works very differently when you have early primaries versus late primaries. And yet Congress imposed the law. They didn't put that in as a factor, and we normally wouldn't. And, in fact, I had raised the question about the amendment, which is in Agenda Document 0655A, having to do with the analogy to the primary and general election rules for presidential candidate expenditures, where the commission had a long and somewhat tortured history of trying to sort out when expenditures in publicly funded campaigns were going to be allocated to the primary and when they were allocated to the general election. And after years and years and years of trying, we finally came down to a bright line date of nomination rule, concluding that no other rule was workable. And that simply points out by analogy that we're following a consistent approach here in the Millionaire Amendment regulation, and that Congress should have been aware when they passed the Millionaire Amendment that this was the way we distinguish between primary and general election expenditures. And so I think this is the right outcome, but because a lot of the atmospherics about this have focused not on the details of the amendment, but on this overall fairness issue, I simply wanted to point out that the statute doesn't say be fair. It's intended to do that, and in fact we've gone a long way to try to ensure fairness by, for instance, in a prior AO, saying that funds that are carried over by the primary candidate are going to be counted to the general election spending limit. I think that's a reasonable conclusion. It was certainly an effort to achieve fairness on our part. It was not the only way we could have concluded under the statute. We could have gone the other way. But I simply want to bring up the fact that this could create another problem. because the cash on hand or the funds received calculation is calculated differently for the primary and the general election, not only is it possible for the self-financing candidate to carry funds forward from the primary to the general, it's also possible for the incumbent candidate to carry primary money forward from the primary to the general election. And so we could reach a situation where we said, well, the self-financing candidate has to do a carry-forward calculation, and we could reach the same conclusion as to the incumbent. Now, with a late primary in September, as in Washington State, the likelihood is the primary money will be gone or substantially gone by the time the primary occurs. But in a state with a March primary, there's a very good chance that money would be carried over. And so my point is that the further we try to go in crafting more and more exceptions and rules to try to reach exact fairness, the more complicated we make an already complicated structure, and the more we run into a danger of anomalous results depending, for instance, on the primary date. Because we've already done one thing in terms of the carryover that'll have a different effect with a late primary than an early primary, and I don't think we want to go further down that road. Lastly, I just want to note that in this particular case, our conclusion might not make a whole lot of difference because, as I've mentioned, the gross receipts calculation is done separately for the primary and the general election. Senator Cantwell had very substantial receipts for the primary election last year, such that Mr. McGavick would have to spend not $2 million, but $3.6 million in the primary before triggering a right, if we held Senator Cantwell to have such a right, for her to receive additional funds. And so in this particular case, while I think we've come to the right rule, in this particular case, even if we read the rule as Senator Cantwell urges, she would still not be eligible for increased funding until candidate McGavick had spent over $3.6 million in personal funds, and to date it's something around $2 million. That, Mr. Chairman, I may have sparked further interest, perhaps not put everyone to sleep, but I'd be happy to move approval of the draft advisory opinion with the amendment set forth in Agenda Document 0655A.
Thank you, Commissioner Mason. No danger of anybody falling asleep when we talk about the Millionaires Amendment. I share Commissioner Mason's thoughts and observations about the conundrum we often find ourselves in construing the Millionaires Amendment. I don't think it's a stretch to conclude that it's the most Byzantine part of the federal election laws. And that's probably saying something, given the other provisions we've worked with over the years. But as Commissioner Mason noted, the key statutory phrase that we're faced with here is expenditures from personal funds made by an opposing candidate. That's what triggers the Millionaire Amendment provisions. And as Commissioner Mason noted, we've historically viewed candidacy election cycle by election cycle, so separate analysis for the primaries and the general election. And I think it's important to note that when the Commission implemented the interim regulations for the Millionaires Amendment in 2002, we saw comment on whether this interpretation was appropriate. And maybe this is not that surprising, but we've received no comments to date in the last 4 years on the Millionaires Amendment. People clearly had other things that they were focusing on. But I think the point is an important one. We reserved the issue for comment, and we took our best shot at it in 2002 in terms of interpreting the statute. I personally think it's the most appropriate interpretation, and we would have the ability to come back later in a final rule if we got comments and other people thought that the statute should be interpreted otherwise. But I think it's a very difficult area of the law. I think, however we come out in interpreting these kinds of statutory interpretations, I don't think we're ever going to achieve total fairness. Sure, Congress is deeply committed to continuing that work in the campaign finance area, but I'm comfortable with the draft before us and am prepared to support it. Additional thoughts on the issues before us? And I know Commissioner Mason has moved approval, but additional thoughts? All right, Commissioner Mason has moved approval of Agenda Document 0655 as amended by Agenda Document 0655A in Advisory Opinion 2006-21. Further discussion on Commissioner Mason's motion. Commissioner Walter.
I understand. I agree with both your comments. I think that it really doesn't give much wiggle room the way the law is drafted in any event. I think we're bound to follow the language. And yes, there are some many inequities, and we haven't received comment from everybody, but I think a lot of people are still trying to figure it out after all these years. Maybe we'll get comment one of these days, but right now I think we have no choice but to go ahead and approve the opinion as it stands.
Thank you, Commissioner Walther. Further discussion on the motion to approve? Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion carries by a vote of 6-0. Thank you, Mr. Knott. Our next item of business this morning is Draft Advisory Opinion 2006-26, which is sought by Texans for Henry Bonilla and by counsel from the esteemed law firm of Wiley, Ryan, Fielding, Jan Barron. And we have Mr. Levin from the counsel's office this morning. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, and I apologize. I think we have a late submitted document on this matter. So, Mr. Vice Chairman, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move for the suspension of the rules for the timely submission of documents to consider agenda document 06-56.
Vice Chairman, so moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries by a vote of 6-0. Mr. Levin, good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Commission has received an advisory opinion request from counsel for Texans for Henry Bonilla, the principal campaign committee of Representative Bonilla, for re-election to the U.S. House of Representatives. On August 4, 2006, a federal court redrew the boundaries of Representative Bonilla's district and four other congressional districts and ordered that a special general election be held on November 7, 2006, in place of the regular general election. The new special general election is open to all who qualify for the ballot per the court order and is not limited to those who had won the primary, such as Representative Bonilla. The Bonilla Committee asks whether the limits on contributions to it for the newly scheduled special general election are separate and distinct from the contribution limits that applied to the regular general election. The draft answers yes. The draft finds that Representative Bonilla's situation is materially indistinguishable from the situation presented by the previously nominated candidates in Advisory Opinions 1996-36 and 1996-37. Accordingly, the draft concludes that one limit applies to contributions made for the regular general election to the Bonilla Committee as of the date of the court's order, which was August 4th, and another limit applies to contributions made for the special general election to the Bonilla Committee after the date of the court's order. However, a committee may not determine its net debts outstanding as of August 4th and collect contributions after that date that are designated for the regular general election. The draft also states that a contribution received by the Bonilla Committee for the March primary need not be aggregated with the contribution received for the regular general or special general election, and that unused contributions from previous elections in 2006 need not be redesignated for the special general election. I will respond to any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Levin. Discussion of the draft advisory opinion. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. I guess I'd like to raise two points. The first is that the conclusion that we reach in this is the same conclusion the Commission reached in a unanimous advisory opinion that was issued in 1996, addressing strikingly similar factual facts, and as a consequence does not strike me as a particularly surprising result. The thing that I think is somewhat different and worthy of note is that that the decision that we're reaching today is a product of a slight change in the processes here. In the last 6-8 months, we made a number of changes to how the agency operates, and one of them is to begin to handle some of the advisory opinions on an expedited basis to the degree that there are facts that make the issue particularly pressing. We've tried to accelerate the time frame in which we reach a resolve on that. In this particular case, approximately 8 days after we received the request, we issued a draft that we are now considering today, and 4 days later we're voting on it. And this is, I think, in large part a product of a lot of hard work on the staff. It puts an additional burden on our lawyers to try and identify, call out these cases, and then try and reach a resolve and present to us a proposal in a really expedited time period. And I think the advantage to this is it provides participants in the electoral process with more timely and effective sense of what the law is on areas where there is some uncertainty. And so I did not want this to pass without expressing my appreciation to the staff in our legal department for putting in additional efforts and times and trying to move these matters forward.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman, and I share your thoughts. I think that when we can dispose of an advisor opinion in 12 days on an election-sensitive issue, that's exactly where we should be as an agency, and I want to thank everybody for their work in making that happen. You know, the statute gives you the right to an advisor opinion in 60 days, or in certain circumstances, 20 days, but when a federal court redraws your boundaries in the middle of the cycle, you may need an answer sooner than that. And so I really appreciate the effort of everybody at the agency to get an answer promptly to the requester here. Additional discussion? Is there a motion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval.
Commissioner Weintraub moves approval of agenda document number 0656 regarding advisor opinion 2006-26. Discussion on Commissioner Weintraub's motion. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries by a vote of 6-0, and the advisory opinion is approved. Mr. Levin, thank you.
Thank you.
Our third item of business this morning is a proposed interim final rule exempting grassroots lobbying communications from the definition of electioneering communications. The proposal was set out in agenda document number 0653, and it was authored by Commissioner Hans von Spakovsky. Commissioner von Spakovsky, any opening remarks on the proposal before us today?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the commissioners know, on February 16th, we received a petition for rulemaking. And it was kind of interesting because we often receive requests for advisory opinions from one political side or the other, but this request that we open up a rulemaking was signed by groups who represent both sides of the political spectrum, included the AFL-CIO, the Alliance for Justice, the Chamber of Commerce of the U.S., National Education Association, and OMB Watch. And that points out something else. It was not just labor unions and corporations and business interests, but it was in large part also nonprofit associations. Now, I've introduced this proposed interim rule as a response to that petition because I believe that our current implementation of the electioneering communications provision of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act seriously impede First Amendment rights. The least well-known of our First Amendment freedoms, the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances, is no less fundamental than the right to free speech, the press, and religion. My proposal is to exclude a narrowly defined class of grassroots lobbying communications from the definition of electioneering communications. This is about protecting the right to petition the government. Anyone who has read this proposal in its entirety can see that it's not an attempt to gut or create a loophole in BCRA. It's very narrowly drawn. The so-called sham issue ads that the electioneering communications provisions restrict would not reappear under this proposal because they don't satisfy its requirements. We had overwhelming support for this petition. We had over 200 comments from charitable, educational, religious organizations. We had only two comments at the time that were negative. We've had an additional comment since then that was negative. All three of those negative comments don't seem to understand the proposal. And I mean, to give you an example, Public Citizen included four what it called sham issue ads in its comment to us, which it said would fit within the proposed exemption that I've made. They obviously didn't read the regulation because the four sham issue ads that they include would fail the standards that I've set out. I mean, to suggest that not every communication that mentions someone running for office close to an election is an electoral ad would seem to be unremarkable, but some people seem to think there's no such thing as a genuine issue ad. I disagree with that. I think there is. The Supreme Court recognized that there were genuine issue ads in the McConnell case. The sponsors of the electioneering communication provision itself, when BCRA was being debated, used that term also. There's been some confusion between this proposed exemption that I've set out before the Commission today and the litigation that we have going on. The only thing I'll say about that is the litigation involves a question of whether there should be some kind of constitutional exemption. That's not what this issue is here. We have very clear statutory authority in BCRA. It says that we have the ability to issue an exemption as long as it does not pass a candidate, which is campaign reform speak for promote, attack, support, or oppose a candidate. That makes it clear that Congress wanted to include a provision to make sure that its electioneering communication provision did not sweep too broadly and that we would have the authority to issue an exemption. This is a very important issue. The right to petition the government for redress of grievances isn't just recognized in the First Amendment. It was recognized in the Declaration of Independence. That was one of the reasons given for our grievances against the king, was his failure to respond to our petitions. It was recognized in 1641 in the Massachusetts Body of Liberties. It's a very fundamental American right. Our current provision, to give a concrete example of this, prevents labor unions and corporations, and that includes nonprofit associations, of which there are thousands in the United States, from running any kind of radio or TV ad within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general election that mentions a or clearly identified federal candidate and is targeted at the relevant electorate. Well, how does this work in practice? Well, let me give you an example. On July 13th, the House of Representatives debated what a lot of people probably consider most important, one of the most important bills it looked at this year, and that was the renewal of the Voting Rights Act. Now, three of the people who were leading the debate, in fact, two of them had proposed amendments to it, were Representatives Lynn Westmoreland of the state of Georgia. John Lewis was a key member of the debate also, and Charles Norwood also. Now, that debate took place on July 13th. The primary in Georgia was July 18th. That means that if any nonprofit organization like the League of Women Voters or a union like the AFL-CIO or a corporation like Walmart had wanted to run an ad on July 12th, the night before the debate and the vote, simply saying and asking people to call these representatives and ask them to vote either in favor of or against renewal of the act, they would have been violating the law and they would have been subject to prosecution by the FEC. I think it's pretty ironic that when debating legislation involving the right to vote, that kind of restriction was in place. Now, if a major member of the Fourth Estate, like Fox News or CNN or CBS, had run an editorial on July 12th on a major network doing exactly the same thing, urging the public to call these representatives and asking them to vote a particular way on this bill, they would have been able to do so. Why? Because there is an exemption within the statute for media organizations. And yet I've heard criticism from media organizations, certain ones, about creating an exemption for example, nonprofit organizations like the Sierra Club or the Wilderness Society or anyone else to run a similar kind of ad. And I think it's important, and I don't want to go through a long list, Mr. Chairman, but I think it's important for people to know the names of some of the people who have asked us to grant this kind of an exemption. I mean, it's everything from the Jewish Community Housing for the Elderly to the Hyacinth AIDS Foundation to the Jesus Lives Here Ministries to the Michigan Nonprofit Association, the Pennsylvania Association of Nonprofit Organizations, the Connecticut Association of Nonprofits, the Maryland Association of Nonprofits, the ACLU, the Sierra Club, the American Cancer Society, the Human Rights Campaign, the Mexican-American Legal Defense Education Fund, the National Council of Nonprofit Associations, the National Lower Income Housing Coalition, the National Partnership for Women and Families, the American Society of Association Executives, which has 25,000 members who represent 10,000 nonprofit associations. All of them have asked us to promulgate an exemption to the electioneering communications provision because, to quote their language, restrictions on legitimate issue ads infringe on the central constitutional right of the people to bring their grievances before their elected representatives. These restrictions effectively shut down grassroots lobbying ads during the crucial closing weeks of the congressional term when Congress is most likely to act on issues of vital importance. Now, being a Republican appointee to the FEC, I don't often agree with the ACLU or other organizations such as the National Education Association. But they have a right to petition the government. They have a right to run these kinds of grassroots lobbying ads, and I support that right. Now, the exemption I proposed is very restrictive. The only way a grassroots issues ad will qualify is if it's directed to an incumbent office holder in his capacity as an office holder, not as a candidate. It has to have as its subject matter a public policy issue under consideration by Congress or the executive branch. It can urge the incumbent office holder to take a particular position on the public policy issue, or it can urge the general public to contact the incumbent office holder for the purpose of encouraging him to take a particular position. It can only reference the record of the office holder by quoting his own statements directly, no paraphrasing, or by reciting his own actions, such as his vote in Congress. It cannot refer to a federal election, it can't refer to a political party, and it cannot refer to his character, qualifications, or fitness for office. And finally, it cannot promote, support, attack, or oppose any candidate for federal office. Now, I've had people tell me that, well, you know, there are sham issue ads that will meet all these qualifications and will still get through, but every time they have told me that, they have not been able to provide me with an example that would do it. And as I said, the one comment we received that included examples of some ads, none of them would meet this requirement. BCRA was passed for the reason of trying to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption in the election process. I don't think that restricting genuine issue ads by charitable organizations, by educational organizations, by the associations that de Tocqueville recognized a long time ago were a backbone of American democracy in any way encourages corruption of the election process that we have. In fact, I think it's the other way around. When you restrict the ability of citizens to participate in legislative decision-making, that's when you get corruption. And this provision, the way it is now, provides a safety period and a good time for incumbent legislators to bring legislation before them for votes, because it's going to prevent the kind of issue ads that might change their minds about how to vote on an issue. And I think it's very important. I know we have a busy schedule and we have a lot of things on our plate, but I believe it's very important that we vote on this today, and I hope adopt it. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Von Spakovsky. I have a couple opening thoughts, and I know my colleagues will have thoughts as well. First of all, I think this is a very important debate for the Commission to have, mainly because of the extraordinary breadth of the electioneering communications rules. As Commissioner Von Spakovsky noted, under the McCain-Feingold law, every corporation and union in this country is restricted from using their general treasury funds for any advertisement that depicts a federal candidate that is run in the candidate's district or state in the last 60 days before an election, no matter its content. It's a very, very broad restriction. Now, it's no question that the Supreme Court has upheld the constitutionality of this restriction against an overbreadth challenge in the McConnell case. But the Supreme Court has also made clear that there is the potential for as-applied challenges to be taken against this provision, and there's litigation ongoing in that area. The reason I think this is a vital issue for the Commission is that apart from the constitutional issues involved here, I think everyone agrees that the agency has a clear statutory mandate to consider and to adopt exemptions in this area. The statute makes clear that any exemption to the electioneering communications rules that the agency might craft must not permit any advertisements that promote, support, attack, or oppose a federal candidate. What I think is notable is that Congress elected to provide the agency with this important exemption authority. The Congress did not have to provide this authority, but chose to do so perhaps out of an understanding that there could be categories of communications where it would be appropriate to exempt them from the broad reaches of this statute. I think the second thing that's very clear is that the federal courts recognize and reaffirm that the Commission has this authority. In the Wisconsin Right to Life decision that the Supreme Court handed down earlier this year, all nine justices concurred and recognize that the agency has the authority to promulgate exemptions in this area. And I think it's fair to say that the court went beyond recognizing this authority, but in fact pointedly noted that the agency had the authority and had not taken action in this area. So I think this is not a question where the courts might disagree about our authority to act in a broad sense. Quite the contrary, I think this is an area where the courts have explicitly indicated that we have the authority to proceed. The third thing that I think is very clear is that in this area, there is a very broad bipartisan consensus that action is needed. Commissioner Von Spakovsky noted the wide range of groups that have petitioned in this matter and have submitted comments on this matter. You know, the ACLU, the National Education Association, the AFL-CIO, the United States Chamber of Commerce. I'm not sure these groups have ever agreed on anything, but they're in here today agreeing that an exemption is appropriate. And I think that speaks broadly to the importance of the issues that we have here before us. The fourth thing that I think is important is that the proposed rule has a number of important safeguards. As Commissioner Von Spakovsky noted, no communication would be entitled to the exemption that references a federal election or a political party. No communication would be entitled to the exemption that refers to an officeholder's character, qualifications, or fitness for office. A communication could only be entitled to this exemption if it concerns a pending legislative matter or a pending matter before the White House. And perhaps most importantly, no communication would be entitled to this exemption if it promoted, supported, attacked, or opposed a candidate for federal office, which is precisely the predicate that Congress laid out in the statute for the agency's rulemaking authority here. So I think there's a number of very important safeguards that are part of this proposed rule. Commissioner Von Spakovsky, I think, has very eloquently laid out the various policy reasons that animate this discussion. I guess where I come down on this is that we have a proposed interim rule here. If we chose to enact it, we could see how it worked in practice. That we've approximately 70 days before the midterm election. We could see how it works in practice. We could get comments from affected people. We could have a hearing, and we could decide whether to make the rule permanent. We have done this in other important areas of the law, and we could do so here if we thought it was appropriate. And if we chose not to make the rule permanent, it is sunsetted to expire in 2007, and we'd have to make that decision then about whether to make it permanent. But I guess my key point is that we have a clear statutory mandate to proceed in this area. The Congress elected to provide this agency with that authority. Congress predicated it on not permitting any ads that promote, support, attack, or oppose a federal candidate. The proposal before us today does precisely that, and we have the ability to take action today to allow interest groups across the spectrum to be heard in the next 60 days on issues of national importance for the Congress and the White House. And I think with all those elements, there's a very strong case for taking action. I recognize it's a difficult area of the law, and I recognize it's not free from controversy. But I think it's an important proposal that Commissioner Von Sikorski has put forward. I think it's very well thought out, and I strongly support it. Additional discussions? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to thank Commissioner Von Sikorski and the petitioners who put in a lot of effort in trying to bring a difficult and important subject to the Commission. I think it's particularly valuable for the Commission to receive input from the regulated community, from people who are out there in the world trying to deal with the complexities of the law and all these regulations on a day-to-day basis and trying to figure out how to do their jobs. And I think it's particularly difficult for people who are grassroots activists, who aren't steeped in the minutiae of everything in those books, who may not have ready access to good lawyers who are steeped in the minutiae of everything that's in the statute and the regs books. I think it's difficult for them to conduct their business when it is affected by our laws. And so I really appreciate hearing from those people. I think I would be the first to say that we don't have a monopoly in this building on all the knowledge or ideas in the world on how to regulate campaign finance, and it's good for us to hear from folks outside. As Commissioner Von Sikorski knows, I have struggled with this issue because I'm sympathetic to a lot of what he would like to accomplish here today and what the petitioners asked us to do and the people who supported the petition asked us to do. I think that the grassroots activists raised legitimate concerns. However, I believe there are countervailing and, to me, compelling concerns that have persuaded me not to support the proposal being put forward today, and those concerns are grounded both in process and in substance. From a process standpoint, we're here to consider a proposed interim final rule. And that is a short-circuited procedure that abbreviates the normal process by which we adopt rules, whereby we would put out a formal notice outlining a number of options in the area that we're considering. We would get comment from people in writing. We would, I think, in a matter of this import, almost certainly hold a hearing and have an opportunity for give and take with people who are going to be affected by this and understand these rules and have perspectives on it. And I think that process is an extremely beneficial one. And it's been helpful to me in previous rulemakings. It's helped me to shape my views and to, and I think it helps the agency reach better decisions. And at the end of that process, we have fully vetted rules and we've considered all of the possible objections and advantages. And we're not at that juncture today. We're not in a position to have that procedure today. And on a matter of this import, I'm just not willing to adopt a major exemption, and I think it would be a major exemption, to a core provision of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act without having that full opportunity to vet all the issues, as much as I appreciate the concerns that have been raised. Now, of course, without going through that process, I haven't fully rested on where the Commission ought to come out on these issues. But I do have some concerns on the substance ground that also weigh in for me in terms of my decision not to go forward today. The electioneering communications provisions bar the use of corporate or union money for any broadcast ad that mentions a clearly identified candidate within 60 days of general election or 30 days of a primary when that ad is targeted to the candidate's electorate. And under the statute, we certainly have the authority to create exemptions to this provision, provided that the exempted ads do not promote, support, attack, or oppose the candidate. Now, we call that PASO because it's tiresome to say promote, support, attack, or oppose over and over again, and the Commission has yet to come up with a precise definition of that term. The Supreme Court has ruled that the term makes sense to political party committees, and the commission has used it in crafting an exemption to another provision of the law allowing candidate endorsements, but that provision by its terms applies to candidates. So it's only been used, the phrase passer has only been used so far with respect to seasoned political professionals who are in the business and, again, have access to lawyers and pretty much know what they're doing. I'm not sure, as I sit here today, without having gone through the full hearing process, that it is meaningful or helpful to tell grassroots activists, people who are not professional politicians, that they can run ads that mention candidates and identify the candidates' positions on controversial issues as long as those ads do not promote, support, attack, or oppose the candidates. I am not convinced that people will understand what we mean when we say that. I'm mindful in this context that the Court of Appeals in the Shays opinion, one of the many Shays opinions, said that merely associating a candidate with a warm and fuzzy issue like veterans issues or the Red Cross in a public service announcement could be enough to generate positive publicity for the candidate and promote that candidate's election. So PASO is a very high bar. It's hard to say much of substance about an issue and mention a candidate without in some way conveying that the candidate has a stand that either is in sync with or in opposition to that of the person who's running the ad. I mean, I suppose we could craft an exemption that said you have to be completely neutral in your description of the issue, but it's kind of hard to figure out how an effective lobbying ad would be neutral about the issue itself. I think that would be sort of nonsensical. When I went through the petitioner's proposal, and again, we haven't had full opportunity to vet that, I think it's possible to comply with all the criteria in that proposal and still pass a candidate. I'm not suggesting by any means that was their intent in crafting that proposal, but I think it could be done. And as long as it could be done, I don't think we have the statutory authority to adopt that particular exemption, because the statute says we can't adopt an exemption that would allow an ad that passes a candidate. And I think that Commissioner Von Spakovsky has at least impliedly acknowledged that problem in crafting his proposal, which adds on the PASO limitation right in the terms of the exemption. So that should satisfy me, right? Except it raises another problem. It's not clear to me sitting here today that there's a consensus view on the commission as to the precise meaning of the term promote, support, attack, or oppose. And if there is such a consensus, it's not clear to me we've made it clear to the public. I have a sense of what the term means, but I don't know whether my sense is the same as Commissioner Lenhart's or the chairman's or Commissioner Von Spakovsky or Commissioner Walther or Commissioner Mason. I just don't know. And I don't want to create a situation where any grassroots activist who wants to run a grassroots lobbying ad within the electioneering communications window has to come to the commission first and ask permission and ask whether that ad complies with the commission's sense of what PASO means. Without a specific definition, I think we're left with little more than an I know it when I see it test. I guess I think I know it when I see it, but I'm not comfortable issuing a rule that is so dependent on the subjective judgment of any four commissioners. Congress did grant the commission the authority to create exemptions, but as I read the legislative history, they intended that authority to be used somewhat sparingly. Representative Shays on the House floor said, "It is possible that there could be some communications that will fall within this definition of electioneering communications, even though they are plainly and unquestionably not related to the election. This section of the law was added to the bill to provide the commission with some limited discretion in administering the statute so that it can issue regulations to exempt such communications from the definition of electioneering communications because they are wholly unrelated to an election." And later on, Senators Feingold and McCain agreed with that construction of what our exemption authority is. The proponents of BCRA, when they submitted comments in 2002, opposed the grassroots lobbying exemptions that were proposed by the commission, came forward with another alternative, but they said at the time that they didn't think it was really necessary. So I think there are a lot of people that want us to do it, to do this, and then there are some that really don't. Some people like the electioneering communications provisions and some people don't, and people tend to have very strong feelings on the subject. But like them or not, the beauty of the electioneering communications provisions lies in their simplicity and clarity. These provisions are almost universally understood and complied with. They are virtually self-enforcing. And we can't say that about too many provisions in the law. We've already talked today about how complex most of our law really is. The provisions work because the law sets up a bright-line test that does not depend on the wording of any particular ad or anyone's subjective interpretation of that wording. And I think this was a conscious decision by Congress, upheld by the Supreme Court, on the grounds that, in the words of the Supreme Court, the vast majority, quote-unquote, vast majority of the ads run within the electioneering communications windows are not genuine issue ads and are for the purpose of influencing an election. Now, a lot of people disagree with that conclusion by the Supreme Court, but I think I'm bound by it. I think that the electioneering communications provisions, as they stand today, function pretty much the way Congress intended them to do. And as I said, some people don't like it, but I do think Congress knew what it was doing. It's been argued that if we adopt a rule today, we could avoid a lot of litigation because we've currently got no fewer than three lawsuits going on about the grassroots lobbying exemptions. I don't think we would avoid litigation. I think we just change litigation. Because if we adopt a regulation, I'm pretty sure that it, we'd be sued over it. And I think it would be useful. It would be useful to me personally to hear from the courts on this issue. And it's true that the Supreme Court has said that there is the possibility of an as-applied challenge, but as Professor Rick Hazen out at Loyola has noted, they provided absolutely no standards or guidance in that opinion as to what that as applied challenge might need to look like in order to be successful ultimately. And those challenges are headed to the Supreme Court, so I'm hopeful that they are going to provide that guidance. I think this is a very difficult issue, and as I said at the outset, I'm very sympathetic to the concerns of grassroots lobbyists, because I think they're out there and they have legitimate needs and they feel aggrieved by this, and I understand that. And I am willing to continue working with my colleagues to try and find a resolution to this problem. I think it may be impossible to draw with surgical precision the precise line that we need to draw to preclude all PASO communications at the same time that we protect all grassroots lobbying. If somebody has come up with a way of doing that, I haven't seen it yet. And at the same time provide clarity and simplicity in the law. I wish that there were an easy way to do this. But again, I think it's something that we ought to consider through a full rulemaking process, and with all due respect to my colleagues who support this, and I understand their concerns, I just can't get there today on this process. Sorry. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Additional discussion? This may be one of the shortest discussions we've had in some time. Commissioner Walther, I knew somebody would step into the breach. Commissioner?
There'll probably be others. The being new to the commission, I feel like I have the benefit of looking at this issue without any personal history involved or invested in the decisions that have been made. I have also talked at some length with Commissioner Von Spakovsky as well as others on the merits of dealing with this rather than ignoring it. I think we should. But I have problems with the way we're approaching it today, and I'd like to just briefly mention those. First of all, I think there can be some misunderstanding with respect to the impression that's given from our debate in terms of the restrictions on free speech. I totally believe in free speech, and I think it's the fundamental right of all of us to express our opinions, especially as individuals, on any subject, almost at any time, as long as it's appropriate under the circumstances. With the law in place now, people who want to participate, who are in unions and corporations, can form political action committees, invest those monies, and use that money for purposes of engaging in grassroots lobbying, referring to identified candidates, and have the ability to use those funds. It's not as if the corporate vehicle and the union vehicle is completely shut out from the debate during this period, and I would emphasize it in all other times other than these limited times. There are, you know, full restrictions, full ability to communicate on these issues. Most of the issues that we're talking about, especially in litigation, have to do with issues that are not ones that just arose. They're ones that have been on the public mind and uppermost in the minds of many for many years. So it isn't that there isn't an opportunity to communicate on these issues with our representatives. There's no restriction except on television and radio. If there's restrictions on other vehicles, there are none in terms of this period of time for corporations or unions to engage in other types of communication to educate the electorate and also to urge action. There's no restrictions during the blackout period, so long as there's no reference to a clearly identified candidate. In other words, if there's an educational ad, just an educational ad, this can be done. And I think, so what's trying to be protected here is a policy that was enunciated in BCRA, and it has strong tensions on both sides. And I'm interested in the debate on how to find a way to deal with it without undermining the base principles of BCRA, which is to, during this period of time, relax in the limited media that's available. Television and radio, there is a limited time available to that for the debate on the candidate. And during this period of time, that's really what's made available. And I believe in free speech, but we all know that free speech can muscle out other speech. And I think the idea here is to give everybody access to a medium that's limited for this limited period of time. Our regulations are not unlimited. As our regulatory power, because the statute says we must enact whatever we do in terms of an exemption to ensure the appropriate implementation of the electioneering communications statute, to ensure the appropriate implementation of it. We've not had that debate to ensure the appropriate implementation of it. And I think we need that debate when we go ahead and do this. There are very strong voices in opposition to this. Granted, there are people on both sides of the political spectrum that feel both ways about this. But I think that if we're going to do something today, we would be premature because we would be shutting out the debate that we're saying is so important. We would today have to adopt a rule in this regard and make a finding under the applicable statute for the Administrative Procedure Act that it is impracticable, that it is unnecessary, and contrary to the public interest for us to have a hearing on this. And since we're talking about the balancing of such important considerations, I think it would be very hard for me to make that finding today, that it is actually impracticable for us to listen to the public on this issue. After all, that's what we're talking about, free speech. That it's unnecessary, that it's contrary to the public interest to hold a hearing, to hear what people have to say on this issue. We're going to go ahead and adopt this rule, given the fact that there's very, very strong considerations on both sides. So I think it would be premature for us to waive the normal hearing rules and adopt a regulation today and cut off free speech on this. I also think that if a rule were to be proposed, I would have in mind some provisions substantially different than that of Commissioner von Spakovsky. If we were to do that, I understand its potentially a legal impediment to make major changes or major structural changes when there hasn't really been given notice in any event. And I'm inclined for us to consider amongst ourselves, okay, let's have a hearing on this. Let's propose our own thinking on it, get those proposals out, and have our day before the people when there is truly free speech. Everybody can come and hear what we have to say, and we have to, you know, we have to try and figure out a way to make it work. I don't think we should be oblivious to the fact that we have three pieces of litigation now that are testing this issue. And I think there will be some enlightenment coming out of that litigation. There's huge amounts of time, effort, and thinking and expense going into this very issue right now. And I think we would be premature to not sit tight and see how some of those issues are sifted out. If we were to do this today, we would be adding an additional ground to declare our rule invalid because of the contention that it's not impracticable, that it's not unnecessary, that it's not contrary to the public interest to hear what people have to say about this. That's a reasonable argument. Now, whether it would prevail or not, I don't know. But certainly would be subject to legal challenge, and we'd just be adding to the litigation issue. I think if we're going to decide the issue, we ought to do it clean of the procedural impediments that would exist if we decided it today, have a debate, and then see where we land on it. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Walther. Additional discussion on the proposed interim rule. Commissioner Mason.
I'm a little undecided about where to start, but maybe I'll just briefly note that one of the philosophical differences here at play is Commissioner Walther noted he was opposed to restrictions on speech and that people should be able to speak out on any subject at any time, and I believe I'm quoting him right, as long as it's appropriate under the circumstances. And I understand that, but there's some people who read the First Amendment and it says Congress shall make no law. It doesn't say Congress shall not make inappropriate laws. None. And so that, I think, is sort of the philosophical divide that sometimes makes it difficult to come to resolution on issues of that of this sort. I recognize that difference of opinion and philosophy, and I just wanted to note that it's there. But I particularly want to note that a couple of my colleagues have talked about the proposal being imperfect and, of course, about the procedure being imperfect. And I agree the procedure is imperfect. This petition was submitted in February, 6 months ago. At least one of my colleagues didn't even want to put out a notice of availability to essentially perform a ministerial act to notify the public that the petition was out here and available for comment. I had understood until more or less today that my colleagues did not want to open a rulemaking on this, didn't want to do anything. As the chairman noted, the blackout period, brownout period, or whatever we want to call it, starts in 10 days. So we didn't do anything for 6 months, and if we don't act now, this, in my view, overbroad restriction, certainly unnecessarily broad restriction, will start to apply, and people will have no relief. And so we either do this today, or there is no relief for the legislative session, which Congress is going to begin in 2 weeks and deal with important issues during that period. And that being the case, I think with all of its imperfections, adopting this rule this way today is the better choice to doing nothing. And one of my concerns about that is that, you know, if we're in a hurry and we're diligent, we can adopt a rule in 6 months. If we had decided in February, hey, we want to do this, we could have had a rule. We could have had a hearing. We could have had comment and could have had a rule before us today. But we were divided in our opinions from the beginning about whether that was worth doing, and so we didn't endeavor to do that. If we now delay, I mean, I said we can get through these things in 6 months if we hurry, but that's an abbreviated process. Normally it takes us a year or so to get through putting out a rule, formulating what exactly we want to put out for comment, getting comment, having the hearing, digesting it, and so on like that. And so if we don't start a rulemaking process now, then in 15 months or so, when the primaries in 2008 start on a very odd schedule that'll have, you know, periods coming in and out when you can mention candidates and not, depending on dates beginning in January or February or whenever states leapfrog into the process, there won't be relief there. And so in my view, if we don't decide now that we're going to initiate a rulemaking process, not only are we denying relief for 2006, but we're very likely denying relief for 2008. And I think that, to me, is an unsatisfactory process, an unsatisfactory result. And so, you know, the argument that, you know, this we need to jump through these hoops is unpersuasive to me, because the reason we didn't start jumping through these hoops is because my colleagues didn't want to do it. So having not wanted to do it when the petition first came in from the beginning, now saying, well, we shouldn't do this because we didn't take all the steps necessary, and, oh, by the way, we're not willing to start those steps now, as I understand it. Now, if we are, that's different. You know, I think it sort of forces those of us who think some relief is needed into saying, well, this is a pretty good proposal. Sure, it's not perfect. I don't know if we've ever had a perfect rule. Maybe the Internet rule didn't attract much criticism. But it leaves me in the position of saying that this is the better choice before us. Now, you know, if my colleagues who want comment and want a full-blown process and want to consider other options are ready to initiate that process, that makes a difference to me. But if we're not ready to initiate that process, then I think the frank answer is it's this or nothing. It's not this or a better rule. It's not this or a hearing. It's this or nothing. And for me, that's a very different choice. A different outcome for me if it were a question of whether we were actually going to initiate this process to consider other alternatives, get testimony, and so on like that.
Thank you, Commissioner Mason. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to clarify a couple of points because I have a different perspective on this. I did vote for the notice of availability. I do think that this is something we ought to be thinking about. And it was not my position, and I regret if you thought it was my position, that 6 months ago, that we just shouldn't do this because we shouldn't do this. As I recall, when the petition came in, we still hadn't finished the Shays round two rulemakings. I lose track of how many rulemakings we've done, but we were under court order to do a certain number of rules. We hadn't finished them yet, and that was our top priority. And we also subsequently have had some fairly weighty matters before the commission. Now, they haven't been done in open session, so we can't talk about that, but you know what I'm talking about. The commission has been busy. It's one of the frustrations of working here, that people sit on the outside, and I was like this too when I was on the outside, and they look at the commission and say, well, you know, what's taking them so long to do X, Y, and Z? What are they doing over there? When, in fact, I think in the time that I've been here, it's been pretty darn busy around here. People have been working late nights on a lot of very important issues, but a lot of it gets done behind closed doors. So it's not so much that we've been sitting on our hands for 6 months saying we just don't want to think about that. We've been pretty busy working on other equally important issues. I disagree with the characterization that, you know, we just don't want to do it. The other point of dispute that I guess I have with Commissioner Mason is that I don't think we're in a position today to open a rulemaking. Again, what I think we need to do in this area is do it in the normal order, is to follow the Administrative Procedures Act. Normally, when we open a rulemaking, we've already got a document. When we have that vote, we've got a document in front of us that we've all been working on for months, usually, trying to sort out all the options. We work with our lawyers, we work with our staffs, we try and figure out exactly what we want the document to say, because there are very tight rules under the Administrative Procedures Act. If we don't lay out an alternative in the notice, we can't adopt it later on. That's kind of frustrating, because sometimes in the course of the hearing or in the comment period, somebody comes up with a really good idea. But we almost have to issue a new notice at that point if we want to consider that. And we don't have that document in front of us today. We're here talking about this today because any commissioner can put something on the agenda, and I understand Commissioner Von Spakovsky felt strongly about this and wanted to get this conversation going and have it today, but we're not in a position to open a rulemaking today. We don't have the documents in front of us. We haven't done the legwork to consider all the options that we'd want to have in that document. So it's... We just can't do that today. As I said, I'm willing to continue the discussions. I do think it would be helpful to get some guidance from the courts. I think that it's been frustrating to me that the commission puts a lot of energy into doing rules, and then they get litigated over, and the courts say, "Silly commission, do it again." And I think maybe we could save ourselves some trouble. And get it right the first time, maybe, if we let the court issue a ruling first. And we know they are going to issue a ruling. How much guidance we'll get in that, I of course, don't know. But eventually, this is already on track. It's heading towards the Supreme Court, this issue. It's teed up. And I think we'll learn something from that opinion, and it would be helpful to us in constructing the rules. I think that if the commission had had the luxury of waiting till it got the McConnell decision before it wrote its first round of BICRA rulemakings, it probably would have written better rules, at least more in sync with where the Supreme Court seemed to be. The commission didn't have that luxury, and as a result, we've had to redo some things. It's a frustrating exercise. And so, as I said, I'm willing to consider to keep working on this, to keep talking about this. But, we're just not in a position to adopt an NPRM today. We don't have it.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. I think a couple things are important to note. First, I intend to vote for the interim final rule if there's a motion offered today. I think the predicates have been laid for proceeding. I think it's important to do so. The nationwide restrictions begin next week or shortly thereafter. So I intend to support that endeavor. But I also intend to vote for a motion to open a rulemaking in this area if one is offered. And I would do that with several commitments to my colleagues. The first is that I would personally commit to include in the notice of proposed rulemaking any proposal that any of my colleagues or the counsel's office thought were appropriate to seek comment on in this area. This has been a historic policy we've had at the commission. I think it's served us very well because it allows colleagues in the counsel's office to work collaboratively on different approaches, and it recognizes that there's no one way of proceeding in any area. So I would make a personal commitment that if we open a rulemaking, to follow that practice and to support inclusion in the notice of proposed rulemaking all the various proposals that any of my colleagues wanted to initiate, including Commissioner Von Spakovsky's proposal that he has here today. The second thing that I think is important to note is that if we decided to go forward on a rulemaking, for me it would be very important that we commit ourselves to proceeding, and proceeding with some dispatch. And I say that for two reasons. First of all, as Commissioner Weintraub, I think, very correctly notes, there's a lot of issues that constantly compete for our time and energy at this agency. That certainly has been the case over the last 4 or 5 years, and I have no doubt that it will continue to be the case in the years ahead. I think that's absolutely right. So the key to getting things proceeding is a commitment at the outset that it's important, and that this would be at the very close to the top of our list of priorities. I personally am very comfortable making that commitment because I think the issue is that important, and I think it's if we proceed down that track, it's important to have that understanding at the outset. The other thing that I think is important is that the courts are looking at a number of constitutional issues in the electioneering communications area, and we don't know how that's going to come out. But I think it's also true that what we're grappling with here today is not the constitutional issue, but the statutory and regulatory issues that are before us, because Congress has granted the agency the authority to enact exemptions in this area, and it's essentially a regulatory and policy choice about whether to do so. And it's a legal choice in terms of how to fashion such an exemption consistent with the requirement that no communications promote, support, attack, or oppose a federal candidate. In my view, that is not of constitutional dimension, that undertaking. It's instead a statutory and regulatory dimension that's been committed to our discretion. I think Commissioner Weintraub's right that if we went forward with an exemption in this area, there could very well be litigation brought by other entities, and we would have to go down that track, as we have gone down that track many times in the last 4 or 5 years. So for me, the predicates have been laid to proceed here today, but I also understand that this is not the normal course to go to an interim rule. We have done so in a number of important areas, but it's not the normal course, and I totally understand that. And that there's no question that when you have a notice and comment process and you have a hearing and all of my colleagues are able to put forward the various proposals in the rulemaking, that is a more comprehensive process, and I'd be supportive of going forward with that. But it would be important if we went down that track that we have a commitment here today that it would be a very top priority of the agency, and I personally would be very interested in proceeding and committing to looking to finish that in the next 6 months because it suggests the weightiness of the issues, and it also suggests how early the 2008 presidential campaign is going to begin. We don't even know when the New Hampshire primary is going to be. As I understand it, the Secretary of State there is threatening to hold a December primary in New Hampshire. And I understand that Mr. Gardner is very good at making threats of that nature, but who knows? Maybe there is going to be a primary beginning then. The point is that process is going to begin before the end of next year, and if we're going to act in this area, it would be, in my view, essential that we do so by the beginning of 2007. 6 months from now would be approximately April 1st, which is April Fool's Day. I don't read anything into that. But if we proceeded down that track, I think we'd make a serious commitment to the regulated community that we were going to finish this action by then, and however it played out. So I guess where I stand is I'm comfortable with proceeding with an interim rule today. I think it's, as Commissioner Mason noted, it's the best choice among a number of difficult choices. But I also want to emphasize that if there are the votes to proceed with a rulemaking, I would strongly support it. But the important thing for me, if we went down that track, is we commit ourselves to moving on an expeditious basis and to finishing the process in that time frame, because I think that would send an important signal about the seriousness of the issue and that we were going to grapple with it. We wouldn't make any commitments, of course, about how it would turn out. And I would make a personal commitment to include any proposal that anybody at this table wanted to include in that document. And to get the full comments, I think Commissioner Walther made a good point, you know, a full range of comments. And that's consistent with the values that are being promoted here, which is a full airing of issues. And I have no doubt that this agency would be lobbied by a large number of people on these issues, and that's as it should be. So that's sort of the two positions that I am prepared to support here today. Commissioner Mason.
I appreciate Commissioner Weintraub's comments, and apologize if I'm a little engaged on this, but it has certainly been my understanding that there weren't four votes to open a rulemaking, and in essence, that was what got us to the position that we're in today. But there's really one thing I want to clarify, and that's the issue as to the courts. And I don't want to surprise the council, but if you know or anyone else readily at hand knows, in Wisconsin Right to Life, which is the case that presumably is going back to the Supreme Court, it's now in the district court, and the hearing is about when?
Mr. General Counsel.
I'm sorry, mid-September.
Mid-September. And the court is under a general order to expedite this, and so, you know, presumably we'll get an opinion this year, but we don't know that. And then a petition would have to be filed with the Supreme Court, and if it's filed that late in the term, say December, we're not going to get an opinion until June. And I think that's optimistic. I mean, council doesn't have anything to say about that. That's okay. But
well, I mean, I think that's mostly correct. There's a right of appeal, which distinguishes the procedural posture of the Wisconsin Right to Life litigation from almost all other Supreme Court litigation, which rarely petitions are rarely granted. In this case, if there's an appeal and there's every reason to expect there would be, it will be heard by the Supreme Court. You're right. There is no assurance as to when a decision would come from the district court. It could come in a matter of weeks. The court has, of course, previewed the issue in conjunction with a preliminary injunction motion, so the issues are not new. But
the court could take as long as it wants, and it could take months, and the longer it takes, of course, the more difficult it becomes to get it calendared. I think that it's likely that the case, if appealed, would be heard by the Supreme Court in the next term. Again, there's no assurance that the court's opinion will issue immediately, and all opinions are typically issued by the end of June. So you're right there that that would be the outer limit for a decision by the Supreme Court.
Okay. And so I just wanted to, you know, that Commissioner Weintraub had referred to the courts and the court guidance and that sort of one calendar, and then the preference for going through the full process here. And I just want to explore that, because if we're going to wait, if we're just going to wait on the courts, then we're going to be waiting 6 months or more. My guess would be June is actually optimistic. I think there are a number of things which could transpire to result in this not getting the Wisconsin Right to Life case not getting to a full hearing at the Supreme Court in the upcoming term. And I suspect if it does, it'll be a late term rather than an early term. And so I just want to understand if Commissioner Weintraub's position is we should wait for that or some other significant guidance before we start the process, or can we start the process soon and incorporate whatever guidance we get from the courts in the interim?
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess it depends on what you mean by start the process. If you mean by start the process, sit down and start the process of preparing the NPRM, tossing ideas back and forth, working with our counsel to see what ought to be included in that, I'm happy to start that. You know, what time does the meeting end? I'm willing to talk to you about that at any time. But would I feel more comfortable getting some guidance to the court before we finalize it and go forward? Yeah, I would.
Additional discussion on the proposed interim final rule. Do we want to entertain a motion? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I'm going to make a motion, Mr. Chairman. I do want to say that I think we have a duty and responsibility to do what we think is correct under the law and the regulations. And frankly, not doing something because of fear of litigation, someone being displeased with what we do, and filing litigation is a recipe for paralysis of this agency, and that we need to proceed as we think is right in this matter. My motion, Mr. Chairman, is to adopt the interim rule that is that I've submitted to the FEC, which is agenda document number 06-53.
Commissioner Von Spakovsky's move approval of agenda document number 06-53, which sets out an interim final rule regarding grassroots lobbying communications. Discussion on Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion to approve. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say I'm not afraid of litigation. Litigation is a fact of life around here. It's a daily fact of life around here. And that's not really what we're talking about.
Further discussion on Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion to approve the interim final rule. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed?
No.
Nay.
Motion fails by a vote of 3-3. Commissioners Toner, Mason, Von Spakovsky voting affirmatively. The Vice Chairman, Commissioner Weintraub, Commissioner Walther voting no. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion that we approve and agree to issue a notice of proposed rulemaking on a grassroots exemption, and that we direct the Office of General Counsel to draft a proposed rulemaking document as a basis. He could use the agenda document we just discussed and would then incorporate into it any changes that the Office of General Counsel believes are necessary and any other alternative exemptions or changes that any other commissioners want to have inserted into it.
Commissioner Von Spakovsky is moving to open a rulemaking regarding grassroots lobbying as a possible exemption from the electioneering communications restrictions, and to authorize the Office of General Counsel to prepare a notice of proposed rulemaking in that area. Discussion on the motion. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We can't approve an NPRM that's not in front of us. And it would be contrary to our normal practice to open a rulemaking without having done that legwork first. As I've said before, I am willing to start that process, but I think the vote to open the rulemaking without having the document in front of us, without having done that legwork, I think it's premature.
Thank you. Commissioner Mason?
I just want to understand, because prior to the BCRA rulemakings, we had a regular calendar that came up, and I have urged, I haven't been a member of the regulations committee since that time, and I have periodically urged at least one of my colleagues who's been on the committee to bring the calendar back precisely so we could deal with issues of this sort. Commissioner Von Spakovsky isn't proposing to issue an NPRM. We're not voting on that, and that's obvious. As I understand it, what he's doing is proposing that we instruct the staff to go ahead and draw up the NPRM that would come back to us. And that's clearly within our authority, and so I don't know why we wouldn't do that. In other words, that we're trying to sort of get to the question of, are there four commissioners who want to go forward with some kind of a rulemaking in this area? Because if the answer is no, then I think the correct thing to do is to close out the interim final rule and tell people, no, we're not going to act, and that may provoke a lawsuit, as opposed to simply sitting on it and doing nothing. And so, I mean, if there's some issue about the detail of Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion, I'm sure we can work that out. I think the question is there a commitment to going forward with the process of getting an NPRM before us, which is certainly something that we've done here at the commission in open meetings before. And further, while this issue is before us today, I thought the process we used previously was helpful because there are other issues on the calendar as well. And so if we go back to that calendaring process, we can have before us the entire menu of issues and understand that, one or another needs to take top priority, or how many can we handle right now, or deal with those sorts of questions. But Commissioner Von Spakovsky isn't proposing to adopt a non-existent NPRM. He's simply proposing to tell the staff to go ahead and start the drafting process.
I think Commissioner Mason's right in that any proposed NPRM that was produced would then be subject to a separate vote and would require four votes to be issued and published in the Federal Register. Further discussion on the motion to authorize counsel to prepare a proposed NPRM. Commissioner Walther, Commissioner Weintraub, I'm sorry, who? Commissioner Weintraub.
I'm going to vote against the motion only because I'm not willing to vote to go forward with an NPRM that I haven't seen yet. And when we get the document in front of us, then we can vote on it.
Commissioner Walther, you'd sought recognition.
I think we owe some something toward toward a commitment. I'm not sure the best way to approach it right now, but my only remaining concern, other than giving the notice that we weren't otherwise going to give today, is to see what comes of the litigation before us. And I recognize we can't wait forever for that. So I would be thinking in terms of supporting a way to support the initiation of a rulemaking when we have that guidance, or after a reasonable period of time, if we don't get it, then to go ahead anyway. And I'm not sure what would be the best date. I mean, June 1st seems to be a date that if we can't get something by then, let's get going with it. But I can't, before that, I'm not too sure whether it would satisfy my desire to see what comes of the issues being litigated right now. So I'm mulling over how to react to that, because I think it makes sense. I think we've all said we're going to get this before us and have a debate on it, however it turns out. I think we owe that.
Are you comfortable authorizing counsel to work on a proposed NPRM, and then we could play it out from there, see what it contains, see what ideas are brought forward?
Well, once again, I don't have a problem with the commencement of the thought process. It's just a matter of what input we're going to get from the Supreme Court on this. And at that point, I think it'll shed light on a lot of the issues that we end up maybe debating uselessly if we see what happens.
Further discussion on Commissioner Boskowski's motion. Commissioner.
I guess I don't understand, Commissioner Weintraub, your objection to this. You say you don't want to do anything until you get a document in front of you, but we're not going to get a document in front of us unless we direct the Office of General Counsel to draft up a proposed rulemaking with the input from all of us on what it should have in it. So unless we vote today to direct the General Counsel to do that, how are we ever going to get you having a document in front of you that lays this out? I don't understand.
General Counsel does many, many things in this agency without having a formal vote of the commission at a meeting to authorize them to do it. They don't need our formal vote directing them to do it to work with us on this. I just don't want to find myself at the end of the day with a document that I don't feel comfortable with and having already voted to go forward with it. So that's all. I just want to. I want the process to go forward. I don't think they need us to vote to talk to us about this, or certainly for us to talk to each other about this.
I would make a personal commitment that any NPRM we put together would include any proposal, Commissioner, that you want in there.
And I very much appreciate that. And that's always been the way we've worked together.
Commissioner Mason.
I have to argue with Commissioner Weintraub's suggestion here. Yes, the council's office, policy division, do certain things without our instruction, but we would be leaving them in an impossible position if we tie up 3-3 here on whether to initiate a rulemaking or not. What are they supposed to do? They got three commissioners who say, yeah, go ahead and do it now, make it a priority along with other things, and we've got three who say no. They can't execute that. They can't do anything. I mean, we've already asked them to draw up a notice of disposition, which they spent some time on because we thought, well, we're ready to do that, and then maybe we're not quite sure ready to do it. And so, while yes, the staff does various things without our guidance, I think particularly in this situation, they need either to be told that this is a priority of some level. Or that it isn't. And I really don't think it's realistic to say that by just doing nothing, having brought it up and debated it and had a couple of different motions and had split decisions, that somehow the staff will know what to do. I think they'll manifestly not know what to do. And again, to me, that sort of non-decision is in essence a decision not to do something. And Commissioner Walter had suggested essentially waiting till June, which I understand. And if that is a position of several of my colleagues, fine, I can understand it. But that's a pretty firm decision that we know where we are. But I don't want to leave us in a position of having a series of motions and saying, well, this doesn't stop the staff from doing something, but then not telling them either that we want something back on the calendar this year, which I think would be sort of the guidance of making this a priority. We've got several months left. I think by December we could have an NPRM back before us. Now, at that point, we may decide not to adopt it. That would still be our option, or to send it back for more work. But there's a big difference between preparing something now, which would get to us probably this year, and waiting until June. And I don't think we're being realistic by saying that the staff will figure it out.
Further discussion. Commissioner Boskowski, would you regard it as a friendly amendment to, in addition to authorizing the staff to begin work and prepare a proposed NPRM, that we would vote on a proposed NPRM by December?
I consider that a friendly amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I don't know what that's going to do, but I'll put that out there. All right. Commissioner Boskowski has moved to authorize counsel to prepare a proposed notice of proposed rulemaking, to work with all FEC commissioners on the contents of that rulemaking, and to vote on the proposed NPRM in December of 2006. Further discussion on Commissioner Boskowski's motion. Commissioner Wolf.
Briefly, I think that if we're talking about the next electoral cycle, we're setting a timetable that wouldn't be necessary to get what we need to get done by then. I again feel that, I mean, if the decision came down by the Supreme Court in October, then all right, that's one thing. But to me, I think we would be remiss in not giving ourselves sufficient time to see what happens. In fact, you know, we litigate. We take our positions before the Supreme Court to get in the middle of a rulemaking while all the briefing and oral arguments are taking place can detract from the points that we're making. So I'm inclined to vote against it just because I don't see a need to do it before the next cycle that would be affected by this. And I again would tell you that if we don't get some guidance by June 1st, then my vote will be to support initiation of rulemaking then. I think we can only, you know, responsibly wait so long. But we would have it done by the time that it would be affected next time around. That's just my thinking on the thing.
Thank you, Commissioner Walther. Commissioner Bosmakowski.
Let me just say, Commissioner Walther, I don't think you're taking a realistic view of the amount of time it takes this agency to do regulations. If by the end or mid-December we are able to take a vote on a notice of proposed rulemaking, and it then is published in the Federal Register, and time is allowed for individuals and organizations to send in comments, and then we schedule hearings, and we get the transcripts back from the hearings, we will be fortunate if we can issue a final rule with a vote by, what, the third quarter of 2007, if we start now. If we can get a rule adopted, a final rule adopted by September or October, which is optimistic because it normally takes a year or longer for this agency to come up with a regulation, then you only have 2 or 3 months before the primaries start, less if New Hampshire switches to December, before the primaries start in 2008 for the regulated community and grassroots organizations who don't usually have access to the kind of expertise in campaign finance law that organizations based in Washington have, to get familiar with these new rules. You know, we need a long lead time to do this, and the regulated community, even when we've done our job, need a long lead time to learn what the new rule is, to train their people to know what they can do and can't do. If we wait till June to even start putting out a proposed rulemaking, it won't get done till mid-2008 or later, in the middle of the election year. And while I understand your concern, I don't think it's realistic. And I do think that if we get a proposed rulemaking in front of us in December, and when we put it out to the public in the Federal Register, if the courts make a decision sometime between then and when it comes back to us, we can certainly incorporate that into whatever final decision we make on it. And I think that takes account of what you are concerned with in the court case.
Thank you, Commissioner. Further discussion on Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion? Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed?
Nay.
No.
I'm sorry.
No. No.
Motion fails by a vote of 3-3. Commissioners Toner, Machen, and Von Spakovsky voting affirmatively. The Vice Chairman, Commissioner Weintraub, and Commissioner Walther voting no. Are there further motions that we wish to entertain before we turn to the notice of disposition? Hearing none, we'll turn to the notice of disposition, which is item 4 on our agenda regarding the rulemaking concerning grassroots lobbying. This is agenda document number 06-57, and it's a late-submitted document. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move for the suspension of the rules for the timely submission of documents to consider agenda document 06-57.
Vice Chairman is so moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries by a vote of 6-0. Ms. Rothstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, Von Cat One, who worked on this notice, is out today, so I'm filling in for him. Agenda document number 06-57 is a draft notice of disposition that the Office of General Counsel prepared at the request of the Commission. The notice responds to a petition for rulemaking that the Commission received on February 16th of this year from the AFL-CIO, the Alliance for Justice, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Education Association, and OMB Watch. The petition asks the Commission to change its regulations to exempt from the definition of electioneering communication certain grassroots lobbying communications. The draft notice states that the Commission has decided not to initiate a rulemaking at this time, although the Commission recognizes that it has a statutory authority to create exemptions to the electioneering communication regulations, provided the exemptions do not permit PASO communications. The notice also states that the Commission may consider initiating a rulemaking on this subject in the future. We prepared our standard letter to the petitioners to tell them about the Commission's decision, should the Commission vote to approve the notice. I'd be happy to address any questions you might have.
Thank you. I plan to support the notice of disposition. I think it makes a couple of important points. First, it makes clear that the agency has statutory authority to operate in this area if it deems it's appropriate, and also makes clear that we're reserving the right to do that if circumstances warrant. It also makes note of the pending litigation that's ongoing in this area, and I know that a number of my colleagues have indicated they think that's an important element for them in terms of how to approach these issues. So I appreciate the notice of disposition. I think it really relies on that very narrow ground in terms of closing the matter down for now and seeing if circumstances change in the future. So I'm prepared to support this notice. It'll provide, I think, important finality in this area, but at the same time indicates that we do reserve the right to come back to this area in the future if warranted. Additional discussion on the proposed notice of disposition? Is there a motion? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, I realize my voting against this isn't going to make a difference, but I feel compelled to vote against it because this is such an important issue to me. And while I understand that we do need to send notice out to petitioners, I mean, I can't agree with the statement in the OGC draft on page 4 where it says that initiating a rulemaking at this time would not be an efficient or effective use of the Commission's resources. I completely disagree with that. What this notice should say is that we're not initiating a rulemaking at this time because of a lack of consensus by the Commissioners. That's the stark truth of what's going on here. It has nothing to do with efficient or effective use of our time. It's a lack of consensus by the commissioners on whether there should be an exemption or what, if there is an exemption, what the provisions of it should be. So I'm going to vote against it.
Thank you, Commissioner Von Spakovsky. Additional discussion? Commissioner Mason.
I move approval of the draft notice disposition.
Commissioner Mason moves approval of the draft notice of disposition as set forth in agenda document number 06-57 regarding grassroots lobbying communications. Discussion on Commissioner Mason's motion to approve. Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
Nay.
Motion carries by a vote of 5-1 with Commissioner Von Spakovsky dissenting. Thank you, Ms. Rothstein. Madam Staff Director, are there any management and administrative matters to bring to our attention this morning?
Mr. Chairman, there are none.
Hearing none, I want to thank all of my colleagues and the staff for the discussion we've had regarding grassroots lobbying. It's a very difficult area of the law. I very much respect the different viewpoints that have been expressed here. I want to personally thank Commissioner Von Spakovsky for his tremendous work in this area and coming forward with a proposal. But I also want to thank everyone at this table for a very frank and open and difficult discussion. And I appreciate it. And I think we have a clearer understanding of these issues, and we can see what action, if any, is appropriate at a later date. But I want to personally thank everybody for this discussion. And with that, we have concluded the agenda for the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for August 29, 2006. This meeting is adjourned.